This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a classical music mini-festival or thought-provoking conversation with artists and community leaders on the subject of gun violence, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Innovative, avant-garde, wildly creative, words often used to describe Hungarian composer Zsorzs Ligeti. Perhaps not a household name, but you may recognize his works, adapted for film soundtracks. Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey comes to mind. To give you more insight, the Birdfoot Festival continues its sixth season with an exploration of the music of this late 20th century composer in a free-to-concert mini-festival it's calling Ligeti Split, featuring celebrated British classical pianist Danny Driver. Danny and Birdfoot artistic director, violinist Jenna Sherry, join us by phone. Hello.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Diane.
Ligeti Split, how did you come up with that?
Ligeti Split is sort of a humorous pun, in a way, on sort of Lickety Split, which is appropriate because of the speed of this music. But also, we've discovered how appropriate this name actually is as we've been rehearsing, because a lot of the music requires the musician to sort of split their consciousness or their ears or their brain into two halves with two very different things juxtaposed and sort of ricocheting off each other. So it has several layers of meaning, but it was mostly meant to reflect the playful virtuosity of this music.
Who was this avant-garde composer, Zsorzs Ligeti?
Zsorzs Ligeti is a fascinating figure in music because he kept sort of reinventing himself. He would sort of do one thing for a while, and then he would change directions. And the music we're playing in this mini-festival all comes from the 80s. And this was a period when he was really reinventing himself with inspirations that ranged from African rhythms to Bulgarian rhythms, music of the Caribbean, really old medieval sort of harmonies and ideas that he was listening to, as well as he was extremely inspired by jazz greats Thelonious Monk and Bill Evans. So the amazing thing about this music is a real sort of cultural mashup of influences from all over that sort of translates in his own way. And although the music is horrendously difficult to play, it comes off sounding fun and very cheeky. There's a good dose of humor in some of it.
There's nothing really in music that Zsorzs Ligeti didn't know, it seems, reading about him. And his range of interest outside music was equally wide. He was a very keen mathematician. He was interested in science. He was interested in literature, Alice in Wonderland, and fantasy world, imagined languages. So it's music that speaks from many places. And it's not music that is in any sense pastiche or eclectic. He doesn't sort of take different things and just juxtapose them next to each other and sort of making a new mashup in a way. He forges an entirely new musical language with all these ideas from different periods and different places as fertile breeding grounds for his material, really. It's very, very special music, and I think the results defy categorization and are easily accessible to everyone and anyone, whether you're talking about a seasoned classical concert goer or someone who's never been to a concert.
At the Birdfoot Backstage Concert, what is the big work that will be performed?
It's the trio for horn, violin, and piano by Zsorzs Ligeti. And the idea is that we will talk about the piece, deconstruct it a little bit. We'll also talk about why a horn trio, you know, what's the reason for composing a piece for these three instruments? What does that immediately bring to mind? What does that say? So there'll be some pointers, if you like, to the history of the horn, the history of writing for this combination of instruments, and the connection, some of the features of this music with world music and things that surround world music.
And this will be Danny Driver on piano, myself on violin, and horn player Roy Feminella, who's joining us. But we will also be performing it. Our goal is really to sort of bring the audience, as it were, sort of inside the rehearsal room backstage in a sort of fun way that they can sort of start to listen to this in the way we do and discover some of the tapestry of connections. But then we'll take an intermission, and then we'll perform the horn trio, which I don't think we've ever done before on a backstage. So this will be a sort of a nice mix of exploration and concert in one evening. And this will take place at 7 p.m. on February 15th at Cook Theater on the Dillard University campus, which is just a lovely venue.
What attracted you to this epic work?
I've always felt it was sort of a good piece to play in New Orleans because of this sort of blend of jazz and world traditions that get synthesized into something completely unique. And also the connections to the piano etudes of Ligeti, which Danny Driver will be performing on Thursday, February 16th, made it sort of an ideal pairing. And the two together give a very rare opportunity for audiences to hear and get to know Ligeti's music, and also to sort of group these works together and show their interconnectedness.
Now, what was going on in the composer's life when he wrote this horn trio?
Ligeti had written his opera, which is called Le Grand Macabre, which is an absolutely crazy, fantastical, somewhat sort of nihilistic, satirical work in the late 70s. And in the early 80s, he actually stopped composing for nearly 4 years, which is quite unusual for a composer. He had sort of poured everything into the opera. And as I understand it, during this period of 4 years, he was teaching, and through discussions with his students, got to know a lot of the music that inspired these works. The idea of writing a horn trio had been proposed to him years before, but he'd sort of sat on it and waited. But he talks about the horn as a sort of slightly a fairy tale mythological instrument, and he uses it in a comical way in this trio, but he also uses it to evoke sort of the history of Europe in a way, in the history of music, and he plays with these cliches and these sounds in this piece.
Danny, can you tell us about the works that you will perform in your solo recital at Tulane?
The solo recital at Tulane features 14 of Ligeti's etudes for piano. Many pianists and piano music appreciators will know the piano etude as a genre that's really about Europe in the 19th century, sort of a romantic idea of the performer as a virtuoso hero who kind of makes everyone swoon and sort of dazzles with technique and musicianship. And that really remained the view, I suppose, the received opinion about piano etudes for years and years. And in the 1980s and during the 1990s, it's Ligeti who came along and really breathed new life into this form. He takes the idea of virtuosity, the spectacle of a pianist on their own, kind of bringing the roof down. He takes it much, much further. He makes demands of pianists that were hitherto really unheard of. And at the same time, musically speaking, he's drawing precisely on all those diverse musics that we've talked about in relation to the horn trio. So the differences between the etudes are quite stunning. I'm saying I'm playing 14 of them, but no two sound slightly alike. They concern themselves with different kinds of harmonies, different principles. There's one where I have to play on keys that I'm sort of blocking with the other hand, so there's a sort of percussive element that comes through. Some of it sounds a little bit like fake Javanese gamelan music. There are certainly some that are very clearly related to the jazz of Bill Evans and Thelonious Monk. There's one which is a musical depiction, if you like, of mathematical chaos, where a stable pattern starts and gradually destabilizes and eventually goes completely out of control. So they're each a world unto themselves. And I just thought, for a program like that, to give myself a little bit of light relief, or lighter relief, and also to give our ears a little bit of lighter relief, Debussy, who's in many ways, I mean, he's the original modernist, but we've been listening to his music for over 100 years, is the perfect foil for this, really. Ligeti was very inspired by Debussy's music. Debussy is perhaps the original composer who incorporated world music into his piano works in a non-folkloristic kind of way. So it's not a case of stylized references, European references to non-European music. It's actually using principles of non-European music to construct works for Western instruments. That's why I feel the two composers go very well, and Ligeti acknowledges the influence of Debussy in his writings. And when you listen through to the program, it's not always as easy that you might expect to be able to tell which piece is by Ligeti and which piece is by Debussy. So I sort of want also to show that music that's been written in our time, concert music of our time, is not necessarily scary, and that music that we tend to think of as normal, that is, you know, a century old, is still as strikingly modern as it was then.
How are you hoping to inspire music lovers and future musicians in these special concerts?
Music is incredible, and I hope the listeners will share in that.
We all want to be moved, be touched, see something in a fresh light. So I hope that this music that has inspired us as musicians so much will inspire audiences in a similar way.
Celebrated pianist Danny Driver and Birdfoot Artistic Director, violinist Jenna Sherry. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Pleasure.
The Birdfoot Festival presents Ligeti Split, a free two-concert mini-festival presented in partnership with the Tulane Newcomb Department of Music, Dillard University, at WWNO, and made possible by the Selle Foundation Fund. Birdfoot Backstage takes place tomorrow night at Dillard University's Cook Theater, 2601 Gentilly Boulevard, at 7 p.m. Reservations are suggested as space is limited. You can hear pianist Danny Driver in recital Thursday night at Tulane's Dixon Hall at 8 p.m. More info is online at birdfootfestival.org. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. We turn now to a much stronger subject as artists and community leaders continue to bring attention to the issue of gun violence in New Orleans and across the nation. In an effort to effect change, local gallery owner and artist Jonathan Ferreira has a new book, Guns in the Hands of Artists, which continues an arts project of the same title begun in the 1990s using decommissioned guns taken from our city streets to foster conversations about gun violence in this country. Jonathan Ferreira is here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Diane. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Gun violence continues to devastate families across the nation. Take us back to the conception of your project, Guns in the Hands of Artists. How did it come about?
Sure. In the mid-1990s, when the murder rate in New Orleans was approaching 400, artist Brian Burrell and I mounted the first Guns in the Hands of Artists exhibition. And the aim of the project then and still now was to take the conversation out of the highly polarized and politicized context and bring it into the realm of art. Art as a means for dialogue, art as a means for fostering a new conversation, and really looking at this issue through the lens of art with the hope that we can find some common ground and use the emotional powers that art can generate to stimulate conversation and change.
So what did you find? What happens when you put guns in the hands of artists?
What happens when you stand in a room filled with artwork made from guns is somehow it's disarming. You are forced to have the conversation about guns and gun violence. And every one of the artists that is in the exhibition and artists that are in the book, about 35 artists from across the country, all use these decommissioned weapons as the raw materials in making artworks in their mediums, whether they're a painter, a sculptor, a photographer, a video artist. So they stimulated conversation. They addressed a specific issue with regard to gun violence and guns in America. And no two were the same, which really speaks volumes to the creativity that was encompassed in this project. And so each one talks about different things from the way that guns permeate our culture. Artist Mel Chin embedded two guns in these concrete busts of infamous killers. Marcus Kenny, an artist from Georgia, from Savannah, Georgia, took a picture of his young daughter dancing around with a gun and talked about the availability of how we don't lock up our firearms and are there regulations to lock up our firearms. So each artist stimulated a conversation. And then when people are in that mix, they're in that gallery, they're in that room filled with artwork, those conversations are stimulated. So the artists are really holding up a mirror to our society and saying, what's happening with guns and gun violence in America? Because I know we all feel this on a daily basis.
What voice would you say spoke the loudest?
Well, every voice has a different perspective. There's an artist named Adam Mysok who's a painter, and he paints these miniature paintings. And he did a series of six bullets, little miniature paintings on the back of six bullets that were embedded into the wall as if they had been shot in a drive-by. And these were paintings of six children under the age of 6 years old whose lives were taken with gun violence in the 6th District. And so that really moved me to think about this issue. And every piece moves you. It's provocative. It's heavy. It's tough. It's an issue that faces us and that we have to face it as well.
Now, you've gathered essays from local and national leaders and activists. What can we look forward to in the book and at the book signing?
The book is an extension of the project. And so through my work at the Aspen Institute and working with Walter Isaacson, who's written the introduction for the book, I was able to reach out across the country to key people, thought leaders on this issue, and some people in the creative community as well. So you have contributions from Senator Tim Kaine, vice presidential candidate, the rapper Lupe Fiasco from Chicago, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Ford, Joe Nocera of the New York Times, Trymaine Lee of MSNBC, Lois Eli, who used to live here and now lives in Los Angeles, the author John Barry, curator Dan Cameron has written about the artwork, Gabby Giffords, the congresswoman who was shot, her and her husband, the astronaut Mark Kelly, have offered also a piece up here, our mayor, Mitch Landrieu. And they're all addressing this. Senator Tim Kaine, he was the governor when Virginia Tech happened. Gabby Giffords talks about being a gun owner and her work with Americans for Responsible Solutions. Trymaine Lee talks about chronicling the loss of life, particularly young African-American men across the country, as a reporter and as a journalist. And then you have Harry Shearer, who will be at the book signing. He talks about his perspective on it, which he said it doesn't make any sense. And in his piece, it comes across as, what is this? Why is this happening in our country? Why can't we figure this out? So at the book signing, Harry Shearer will be reading his reading for the book. Councilwoman LaToya Cantrell will also be choosing a reading from the book. And Melissa Sawyer, the Youth Empowerment Project, will also be reading. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the book and the process about how it came to be. And then we're going to have a question and answer session. And a lot of the artists will be there to sign books as well.
Can you share a story with us, one that you found compelling from the book?
Oh, yes, definitely. There's a story written by Lucia Macbeth. And Lucia Macbeth is the mother of Jordan Davis, a young man who was murdered in Jacksonville, Florida. I met Lucia Macbeth at the Aspen Institute when she was presenting her film about her son. It was called 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. It was on HBO last year. Lucia Macbeth writes in her essay, "They say that time heals all wounds. I beg to differ. When a mother loses her only child to senseless gun violence, the wounds never heal. We only bandage them nicely to prevent the rest of the world from seeing just how deep and painful our loss is. My son Jordan Davis was murdered in November 2012. He was murdered for playing loud music in his car with friends. He was murdered by a man who harbored a deep hatred for my black male child, and through the barrel of his gun, he acted out that bias. And now every day I am faced with the reality that I live in a society that does not value my son. Under the law, people are empowered to shoot to kill others like him. Our political leaders have asked for thoughts and prayers for the many victims of gun violence in this country, but that is not enough. We are living with a national crisis. Critical solutions are long overdue. How much longer do we walk in fear at the mercy of gun owners who shoot first and ask questions later? Our country's unique gun violence crisis and its unacceptable easy access to guns emboldens dangerous people to commit crimes every day. I am not so sure we will recover. The only assurance I have is that I no longer have to worry about my son because I know he is safe and rests in the arms of God, free from guns, free from violence, and free from the racial biases imposed on our humanity." And also Mitch Landrieu, the mayor of New Orleans, writes in his essay about the power of art. He says in his essay, the famous Russian author Leo Tolstoy said, "Art is not a pleasure or an amusement. Art is a great matter. Art should cause violence to be set aside, and it is only art that can accomplish this." And lastly, as I look at this book and I look at this effort and all the people that are involved in it, I ask myself this question every day. Does it make a difference? And as one artist replied, "Depends on your definition of difference." So I say to myself and I say to everyone else, if not me, who? If not now, when? There's a lot of different perspectives in here. There's the personal, there's the political, there's also the policy part of things, trying to make sense of this crisis that really affects our country.
You are using art as an agent for change. What change have you seen since the project's inception 2 decades ago?
This is a long-term project. And I'd say this, that a couple of examples from history that are very important. And Walter Isaacson writes about this in the book. He said that art has always had the power to change society and show us a way to a better place. In 1906, Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle about the meatpacking industry in Chicago. 20 years later, that led to the founding of the FDA. The protest songs of the 1960s. What do we remember from the 1960s? Is Bob Dylan, you know, the answer is Blowing in the Wind. Those musical elements, art leading the way in some way. It's not going to change immediately, but art has the power over time to shape a conversation, to shape public sentiment, and to hopefully lead us to a place that has common ground and positive change. Toni Morrison once wrote that in times of dread, artists must never choose to remain silent. And I think that that's really important to ponder that, because artists have the responsibility to challenge society on multiple levels and make us as a society see what maybe we can't see, but art can possibly shine a light on that. So are we making change? I'd like to think we are on a daily basis, but it's a long, long road. And I think as we read the news on a daily basis, we see that. But any change, if we save one life, that's a positive change. If we change one person's perspective, and hopefully common sense takes over, common sense legislation, common sense reactions, common sense answers, then maybe we're moving in the right direction.
Artist, author, and gallery owner Jonathan Ferreira, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
Jonathan Ferreira will be joined by essay contributor Harry Shearer and Guns in the Hands of Artist Project Partners, Councilmember LaToya Cantrell and Youth Empowerment Project's Melissa Sawyer for a reading and conversation about art, activism, and gun violence in the New Orleans community. Tomorrow evening at Garden District Bookshop in the Rink Shopping Center, 2727 Britannia Street, from 6 to 7:30. The event is free and open to the public. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.